From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. For a writer-turned-emergency room physician, his breakthrough moment came with a realization.
Not all patients wanted answers. Sometimes they just wanted someone to talk to. Sometimes they wanted an understanding. Sometimes they wanted someone who was going to be able to sort of listen to them and maybe just share their struggles with them.
Later, Bubbler Talk tells the surprisingly complex history of how Milwaukee's aldermanic districts were formed.
I better let the city council, who lied in the past and who manipulated to the detriment of poor people, I'm not going to let them trash us in the state.
Milwaukee novelist Nick Petrie talks about the fourth novel in his Peter Ash series, due out next week.
And a recent documentary chronicles the intriguing family dynamics at work in a Milwaukee Chinese restaurant. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Not long ago, there was a very public debate on Twitter between the National Rifle Association and an emergency medicine doctor. The NRA essentially contended that doctors shouldn't weigh in on matters of gun policy, while the doctor said it was precisely the place of his profession to weigh in. The incident was a very high-profile example of the willingness of doctors to enter the public discourse.
But Twitter is obviously not the only way physicians outwardly express themselves. Dr. Jay Baruch is an emergency room physician in Rhode Island. He's also a writer, the author of several collections of short fiction, and director of the Medical Humanities and Bioethics Scholarly Concentration at Brown University's Alpert Medical School. He gave the annual Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin in November and joined us in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Scott. It's great to be here.
What does teaching medical humanities look like in the program where you work at Brown?
It's a great question. I think that's the larger question is actually what does medical humanities look like in general? And I think it could be many things to many different people. I mean, for me, medical humanities, I focus heavily on the humanities part. And for me, like, humanities is about critical thinking, questioning norms, critical inquiry, thinking differently about problems, thinking about other perspectives and different points of view. And it's also heavily grounded in my clinical work. There are people who do wonderful theoretical work in medical humanities, and that's fantastic, and I love the fact that they're doing that work. My approach to this and my fascination with this work really is informed by the practical challenges and that I encounter in my daily work as an emergency physician at a busy level one trauma center.
Well, and so how do these kinds of issues and where the humanities intersect with them, how do they manifest themselves in a trauma level one medical center?
Well, for me, at the most basic level, it's about story, the element of story. I come to this work as primarily a creative writer who found himself stumbling into this world of medical humanities. There was not a lot of people doing this work. One of the thrilling aspects of being out here is that Art Jersey, who's at MCW and directs the program Medical Humanities and Bioethics, was really someone who has inspired so many of us. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so thrilled to be out here. But it's really at the level of story, patients come to the emergency department with a lot of different reasons. If you come in a cardiac arrest, I know what to do. If you come in with a gunshot wound, I know what to do. If you come in with a terrible infection and your blood pressure is dropping, I know what to do. But the doors are always open, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And we know that our communities are experiencing challenges. Our healthcare system probably could be in a better place. And there are a lot of needs that go unaddressed. And a lot of times people come to the emergency department with problems that are not apparent. They don't follow an algorithm. And what they bring is their stories. They bring their needs. They bring their expectations and their hopes. And unless you're thinking in that way, You're thinking about who's telling the story and why they might be here. You can miss some really important information that's actually necessary to be a great doctor.
It's interesting when you think about it. Hollywood kind of appreciated the storytelling possibilities around medicine a long, long time ago. And it seems that the medical profession only wrapped its head around them more recently.
I was. Do you think so? That's a great point. I think if you look back, I don't know whether it's the fact that we're not recognized. They didn't recognize it previously, or maybe it's because we've had so many really wonderful physician writers or clinician writers who are producing great work and bringing attention to that. Is it maybe because of social media and we're seeing a lot more clinician writers, musicians, performers, people who are telling the stories of medicine?
Right, maybe it's more grassroots today than it used to be.
I think so. And I think also because of that, you're also getting, I think, probably more honest and authentic stories about the experiences. You know, it's oftentimes there isn't a big happy ending. There's not a big moral or lesson to be learned. Sometimes it's just people struggling to get by. And I think that's an important message to get across too.
Well, it's interesting because I've been reading and seeing a lot in the media, you know, both social media and you know, more the news media from the community of emergency physicians, you know, in the wake of events like mass shootings, some of it in response to each other, so the community of physicians responding to each other, and some of it in response, you know, to pundits and you know, more societal speaking. But the point, I mean, maybe the point of the question isn't to talk politics and issues, but to just notice that we seem to be seeing more doctors participate in broader social discourse in more ways today than we once did.
Yeah, and I think that's probably for a couple of reasons. One is, as we discussed earlier, is just social media and people have platforms to investigate these issues which they're passionate about. Also, I feel that technology is also pushing the boundaries of what falls under the boundaries of what it means to be a physician or a clinician. I mean, before, you know, our level of concern was in the emergency department. But now we realize that a lot of quote-unquote health problems, medical problems, really have community issues. There's social justice issues, and I think there are a lot of physicians out there who are actually doing a great public health work. And it's also a way to connect and communicate with our communities in a more powerful way rather than just sort of dealing with them when they come through the sliding glass doors.
Was there a light bulb going off moment for you when you realized that you could weave these two parts of your life together as, you know, a doctor who writes or a writer who practices medicine?
I don't think that a light bulb necessarily went off. I think there was a slow flickering and then it just sort of stayed on longer and longer. And this, you know, happened, I think, years ago, and it largely resulted of my frustration, because a lot of the things that made me frustrated when I was taking care of patients were often those problems that was really fraught with uncertainty. And I didn't have an answer, and it didn't feel good. And I soon recognized that, you know, not all patients wanted answers. Sometimes they just wanted someone to talk to. Sometimes they wanted an understanding. Sometimes they wanted someone who was going to be able to sort of listen to them and maybe just share their struggles with them. And sometimes it was just to recognize that they're not a body full of biomedical problems, but a person. And I started thinking more like a writer. I was borrowing a lot of my writing skills and taking it to the bedside. And that not only helped me with my feelings of anxiety when I was facing situations fraught with uncertainty, but I also felt that it allowed me to engage with my patients in a way that felt more natural to me.
I gather the program at Brown goes beyond just writing as what the medical humanities look and feel like.
Well, medical humanities encompasses many different facets, skills, curricular objectives. I mean, it can be writing and focusing on story. A lot of the work we do is also focus using museum objects. We do a lot of work with the Rhode Island School of Design, RISD Museum, which basically we use visual objects as complex bodies of information to get clinicians, students, to get them to think about how they think, how they process information. We have people doing work with illustration, and I think the opportunities that fall under the umbrella of the humanities, especially at medical schools across this country, are expanding.
When do students at Brown first engage with the humanities as part of what they're doing in med school?
Well, there's a little bit of a complicated question. We accept a certain number of students into the medical school who actually go through what's called the PLEMI program, the program in liberal medical education at Brown. And many of them are doing humanities-related work as undergrads. Mm-hmm. And so I have the good fortune of encountering many of them when they're young, you know, and they're full of their passions and they have the good fortune to be able to continue a lot of that work when they enter medical school, and they encounter it in bits and pieces throughout the curriculum. There's a lot of electives that they can take, and there's a lot of opportunities with many people at both the medical school and at the university at large who are doing great work.
But in a lot of ways, it's a more organic process for them than the process you described in terms of how you yourself became, this writer who practices medicine or physician who writes. You know, that came later as you already were wrestling through some of these issues that perhaps this next generation of physicians either won't have to wrestle with or will wrestle with in a different way.
I think the wrestling in a different way is probably the better term, because it's not a pill, right? It's not a treatment. You can't write a prescription and say, listen, look at this painting, read this poem, and you're going to get something out of it. You are committed to it as well, and it's an iterative process, right? You bounce off the material. You think about it differently. You'll think about it differently from the moment you experiencing it to a couple of months later, maybe a couple of years later. I like to think about this work in the same context which I think about my writing, which oftentimes includes the idea of space, like leaving room for the reader, you know, and what the reader brings into a work, or what the listener brings to a piece of music, or what the viewer brings to a work of art is just as is pivotal. And I think making that space for students to engage in it on their terms in a way that's meaningful for them, and to be able to provide guidance and maybe reflect for them why it's important for you is sometimes the most that I can do.
Is there, and this is maybe an unfair question, because you, when you are a patient, your aim is to be helped by your physician and your medical team, and at the same time, I wonder if there's also some room that a patient would be best suited to give his physician in the same way as a reader, you know, gives to the art or to the book, or the person viewing a painting gives to the art.
You know, we talked earlier about the role of social media as ground roots for physicians to engage with a lot of the problems and challenges that they see facing their patients. I feel social media and technology has also helped change the discourse in which patients themselves are helping to drive the conversation. There's so much about being said and heard about patient empowerment, and that's so important. I mean, it's one thing to be able to listen to a patient, but thinking about it through your own eyes, but processing it from what they're saying. And another thing to really authentically listen to what our patients are telling us and letting their voice be the final say, and being open enough being savvy enough to recognize that even though there might be things that you do not like hearing, it's really important to recognize and understand that there are people having experiences out there that we can't truly understand fully. That doesn't absolve us from making that those important gestures to understand it as best as we can, but we have to honor them, and we have to give it legitimacy, and we have to learn from what they're saying.
I know physician burnout is a significant issue in the medical field, especially in places sort of already underserved by medicine. I wonder when you are able to engage this other part of you, this writer part, are you a happier or more fulfilled physician?
That's a great question. I used to convince myself that there was no bearing on the two. But I do feel that when I am I'm a better physician when I'm writing. And I'm trying to unpack why that is. It could be having that space to myself. It could be because I'm thinking about issues in a more intimate way. Oftentimes I'm going to pretty dark places in my writing, at least as the basis for moving forward. I've burnt out, right? And I burn back in, and I burn out, and then I burn back in. I think what's important is to recognize that sometimes, like when you're truly human and you really care, especially in this system where it's oftentimes not designed for the better of patients, nor is it necessarily designed for the health of physicians, that to be able to have these opportunities to reflect, to let it get out of you into some space. For me, it's on the page. For others, it might be in a painting or video or a blog or a podcast or 5-mile run is absolutely essential, but it doesn't change the fact that we do have some structural changes that have to take place in medicine, I think, to improve the health of our patients and the providers.
Dr. Jay Baruch, thank you so much for spending some time with us and really kind of shedding light into how the humanities makes a difference in what you do.
Thank you very much.
Jay Baruch is an emergency room physician and the director of the Medical Humanities and Bioethics Scholarly Concentration at Brown University's Alpert Medical School. His most recent book is a short fiction collection called What's Left Out. He was in Milwaukee in November to give the 13th annual Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin.
Next on the show, Bubbler Talk relates a little told or understood chapter in Milwaukee history. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Angelina Moser Salazar. And if you're familiar with downtown Milwaukee, you probably know the historic Third Ward. The neighborhood with shopping, dining, and theaters, just south of I-794. Now, listener Steve was thinking about the Third Ward when he sent us this question.
I was curious about when the change from wards to district occurred and under what circumstances.
Steve is referring to how areas of the city are carved up today into aldermanic districts. I decided to look for the answer, starting at City Hall with the alderman of my district, Robert Bauman.
I haven't heard this question posed by many people because we had to dig around to find the answer, but it turns out,
in the 1970s, the state chose to throw out the name ward and replace it with district. A technicality, housekeeping. I thought that was the end of a pretty cut and dried story, until I got a phone call. It was former Democratic State Representative Fred Kessler. He told me I was wrong. The change from wards to districts was not a simple matter. It had everything to do with redistricting. Back then, the state constitution required lawmakers to use county boundaries and city ward lines to draw assembly districts. But with a growing city, in part because of the great migration of African Americans from the South, that was going to be mathematically impossible. The solution? Break Wisconsin into thousands of tiny pieces. Lawmakers called the tiny pieces wards.
We could have used precincts. We could have used that. We decided the Constitution says wards, so we'll redefine wards.
The term ward could no longer apply to the areas aldermen represented. So the state renamed those areas districts. Kessler says this was a big deal. The move let state lawmakers circumvent the city in the redistricting process. He says he fought for the change to stop race-based gerrymandering.
The white fathers of Milwaukee decided that they are not going to end up having a second African-American on the council or on the county board or in the state assembly. And so they gerrymandered the maps so that the African-American constituencies were split substantially so that there was no ability to elect a second African-American.
Kessler says in 1971, the city's map claimed each aldermanic ward had roughly 39,000 people. But in truth, the numbers were off by thousands in some areas.
What evidence is there to corroborate what you're saying?
You and I could walk to City Hall and we could go into the library.
And we did. I took Kessler up on his offer and we walked to the City Hall library where he compared what he says was an accurate state map to the erroneous city map.
They lied. They absolutely lied.
There was a discrepancy in numbers. But was it enough to hold up Kessler's claim that white city leaders were trying to dilute the black vote? I asked Milwaukee historian John Gerda, and he said the chance of finding proof of intent in the public record is remote. But
whether the intent was declared or not, it's quite reasonable to allege there was a racial factor in drawing of lines, and that factor would have been intended to kind of dilute or weaken the influence of African Americans.
Gerda says the claim would be in line with a pattern of African American voter suppression across the country at this time. And what is certain is that in 1972, the redistricting bill fundamentally changed how the state could draw the lines, giving legislators in Madison unprecedented power for better or worse. Angelina Mosier Salazar, 89.7, WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Milwaukee, serving more than 41,000 children and teens each year, dedicated to providing safe spaces, academic enrichment programs, and fun environments. More at bgcmilwaukee.org. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Keep listening. When we return, local author Nick Petrie is launching his fourth Peter Ashe novel. We'll hear about it when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For the past few Januaries, we've sat down with Whitefish Bay author Nick Petrie as he shared the first three installments in his series of novels featuring ex-Marine combat veteran and Milwaukeean Peter Ashe. Number four drops on the 15th, next Tuesday.
Nick Petrie launches the book at Boswell Book Company the night before in a conversation with yours truly. But if you just can't wait for a taste of this new novel called Tear It Down, Nick Petrie joins us now, and I asked him whether he'd ever expected or imagined we'd be talking about book number four.
No, never. I never thought the first book would see the light of day, and here I am. The fourth book is going to be out any minute. I'm revising the fifth book. I've got plans for six and seven. Life is strange and wonderful.
As we get to know our hero, because he is, and this is one of the things we have talked about over the years for every book, he is complex. He's not black and white. He's not easy. He's not pigeonholed or easily pigeonholed. But as we get to know him more and more, and in this book particularly, we get to know him in a different way, I think. I mean, was that intentional for you? I mean, we delve into, we know about the PTSD, but he's working on some interesting pieces of that.
Well, the goal is with every book to kind of move him a little farther down his timeline. And when I started all of this, I don't think I really knew enough about post-traumatic stress and what a big deal it is for many people. And so I sort of thought, well, I'll write one book about a guy with post-traumatic stress and then it'll get better and it'll be about something else. But the more I learned and the more people I talked to, the more clear it is that for some people, this is something that really lasts in some way or another through their whole life. And so I wanted to kind of chart the path of him working through these issues of what it's like to have been to war, to have been in combat, you know, for an extensive period of time, which really messes with you. And some people can do it with no problem at all. But for most people, there is a period where you really have to reckon with it. And that was sort of my goal, was to sort of show that evolution through time. But also, every book can't be about this particular issue. And so I wanted him to sort of be out in the rest of the world a little bit and to use some of those same – to see how some of those same issues really are experienced by people in other worlds. There's a great piece on Chicago Public Radio a couple years ago about how young people who live in areas where gangs are prevalent show all the symptoms of post-traumatic stress. So if you're a 17-year-old high school kid and you are trying to avoid that life, you know, you see, you know, you're in that kind of neighborhood, you get shot at, your friends die. I have friends who've been through that. So I wanted to kind of show that aspect of it. And I have a character named Wanda Wyatt who's a war correspondent. She's a combat photographer. Because I've talked to people who have been journalists in war zones, and what's that like, and what effects do that have? So I wanted to sort of see what the other ramifications of that would be for other people in those kinds of situations.
Well, and putting them all together in this one story is interesting because you get to see those different threads, and you have a teenager who is a musical phenom, but who's in the middle of a very, very ugly situation in his hometown of Memphis, which is where the most of this book takes place.
Right. Well, and one of the challenges I set for myself for this book was that I wanted to tell these two sort of parallel storylines. So we have this this young guy, this 15-year-old kid named Eli Bell, who's a musician, who is trying to keep himself out of sort of the gangster life in Memphis, in a place where there really aren't other paths. There aren't that many other choices. But as often happens, his friends kind of rope him into something. And so I wanted to tell Eli's story as well as kind of what's happening with Wanda Wyatt, this combat photographer, and with Peter being sort of the link between the two, Peter Ash, my hero. And I'd never really told this sort of braided sort of series of stories before. And so that was kind of the thing I was trying to set for myself. And it was weird. It was a very different thing to do. But that's part of, you know, the goal is to keep trying to do something different, to not just tell the same story over again.
One of the things that I noticed about Peter in this book is talking about the PTSD is that there are moments in here where he's reconciling with it in a way where he realizes that he enjoys it. There's parts of it that he really likes, and he wants that feeling of that adrenaline and the feeling of rising to that occasion. And we've seen that in him before in the other books, but it's like he has a self-awareness, I think, in this book that maybe he's earned over time. Maybe he's earned it because he's spent time with June, who's not really – she's there but not really in this book a lot.
No, there's a bit less of her in this book. And that's deliberate, is because, the goal wasn't to have every book be sort of how they are together and how their relationship is evolving forward. It's just sort of allow that to unfold a little bit from book to book. But, you know, that's really the dirty secret of war, is that it's exciting. And that's how we get young men to go risk their lives, is that there is this sort of adrenaline component to it, and along with this intense camaraderie that comes from being this close-knit group of people going through, this incredible crucible of experience. And, you know, there are veterans who, one of the components to the challenge of coming home from a war zone is that they miss that. They miss the camaraderie and that feeling of connection, which is really hard to obtain any other way.
Well, particularly for men in our society, you're not supposed to have those kinds of close bonds with other men.
Right, and men often don't really learn how to build those friendships. Whereas I think for women, it's one of the things that you learn in your childhood. And you know, for men, it's, you know, in our culture at least, it's really about being stoic and being strong and, you know, suck it up and go to work and all that stuff. But those relationships, I mean, that's one of the things I'm really trying to convey is the intensity and the pleasure of those relationships. But it's also part of what makes it hard to go back to, you know, the so-called normal world is how do you create something that is hopefully less lethal but still as rich and invigorating as, you know, this terrible combat experience.
Well, you mentioned Wanda, the combat photographer, and the reason Peter is in Memphis is because of her and because June sent him there. And you've managed somehow to talk about tying things together in interesting ways. You know, she's in a house that people are sort of blowing up or trying to.
Well, and that's what kicks this whole thing into gear is Peter, my protagonist, is, you know, kind of restless at home and he's trying to find an excuse to go have another adventure and to you know, kind of scratch his adrenaline itch. And June sort of sees this in him and says, well, I have a friend in Memphis who's being harassed. And by the time he gets there, somebody's actually driven a dump truck into her living room. So Peter's job is to find out kind of who's harassing her and why and all of the, you know, that's one of the threads that starts to unravel.
And of course, one of my favorite characters makes a return visit, and that is Lewis. I think everyone loves Lewis. There's just something about Lewis.
People do love Lewis.
I want him to be my friend. I really do.
Well, and there's something about Lewis in that Lewis doesn't particularly care what anybody thinks. Lewis has his own path that he's traveling, and he plays by his own set of rules. And there's something that is, I think, really appealing to those of us who, you know, set the alarm clock every morning and we go off to work and we do the dishes and we go to the grocery store and all those things. He is just a blast to write because I get to indulge that part of myself that wants none of those things.
But Lewis has those things. He just goes away from it a lot.
Right, right. Well, my line is that he's a semi-reformed career criminal. Or he likes to think he's reformed, except, you know, like Peter, he sort of misses the action. So he's looking for any excuse to go play.
Well, and he and Peter have such a wonderful connection, too. And we see it in different ways. I mean, of course, they have each other's backs and all of that. But I remember as I was reading this book thinking, oh, we're talking about some interesting stuff here that they haven't really talked about before. They've kind of touched, and we're talking about race, we're talking about friendship, what that means, friendship between men, friendship between men of two different races. And there's just some interesting stuff that kind of has come out in this book that I hope you're going to continue with.
Well, I've always seemed to find myself writing about both something that's sort of happening in my own life and something that I'm observing in the culture and something I'm interested in. So when The Drifter, my first book, is really about veterans coming home and was also about sort of the aftermath of the financial crisis. Both two things that I really couldn't stop thinking about. The next book, Burning Bright, is really about emerging technology. It takes place on the West Coast I read a lot of science fiction growing up, and so it was a chance to play with some of that kind of stuff. But I think those are real issues too, in that, you know, the world is changing quickly, and we are not being very deliberate about our choices, about what we're choosing to adopt and what we're not choosing to adopt. You look at social media, you know, all of those things. The third book was about was set in Colorado, and it's about the newly legal cannabis industry. And, you know, so what are the ramifications of that? And this book, I didn't really set out to write about, you know, race and class and friendship. But when you set a book in Memphis and, music is a part of it. It's almost inevitable, especially kind of the way that my work sort of shows up. So I'm not sure I could avoid it. The funny thing about this book is there is no earthquake in it, but I picked Memphis in part because it's the center of something called the New Madrid Seismic Zone. We think about earthquakes in the West Coast, but this is the site of four of the largest earthquakes in recorded American history in the early 1800s. And they think that there's another one that's, you know, kind of due any minute. And I had this sort of elaborate plan with this earthquake and all these different groups of people were going to come together. And of course, you know, my plans always sort of get turned on their head and the earthquake never shows up. And I'm writing about, you know, these people and their relationships, which is what interests me.
Without giving anything away, I have to say that final chapter is quite breathtaking.
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you. That's the goal. I see how long you can hold your breath.
Yeah. It was like, wow, wow, wow. That must have been fun to write.
It was fun to write. It's an interesting process to I don't outline. I sort of write forward. And sometimes that means I have to write backwards because I it goes a direction that it turns out it shouldn't really go, or I have to go back and revise something to make it all fit in. But to discover as I write, to have this an incident kind of emerge out of midair, and I don't want to spoil this for anybody who's has not read this book, and I don't think anybody who's listening to this has really read this book because it's not out yet. But my last book, there's a gurney ride down a mountain road.
Yeah, I remember that.
That I didn't plan. It just sort of came about in the through the course of the story, and people kept talking about it. People talk about it to me. I had a conversation about it 3 days ago, and it's not something I planned. I could never. What a ridiculous thing to put in the story. But it sort of arose naturally, and I think it's believable because it arose naturally, and that's part of the fun is to sort of. You know, to be lying in bed in the middle of the night and have this idea just pop into my head.
And you go, ooh.
Yeah.
Let's see where that one goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you think people in Memphis are going to react to how you drew their city, how you created their city?
I don't know. You know, I'm always a little concerned about that. And this is the first book I've written about a place where I never really had a personal connection. Right, so I wrote a book about Milwaukee, which is easy because I grew up in Milwaukee. I live here now. I wrote a book about the West Coast. I've traveled all over the West Coast. I lived in Seattle for 10 years. I wrote a book about Denver and Colorado, and I've traveled through Colorado, and I have friends there. But, you know, I'd never been to Memphis. I wrote half the book before I went there. But I had spent time in Detroit, and there are some similarities. They're actually have a lot of similarities to Milwaukee on a certain level, where we have our deeply challenged urban core, where most of the work and most of the money is outside the city proper. So that was kind of my access point. But you know, I try very hard to keep the setting real. You know, if I'm describing a patch of woods in the middle of a bad part of town, that patch of woods is really there. If I'm describing a building, there's a juke joint in this book. It's based on a real juke joint. I mean, I've spent time in Memphis, so I spent a lot of time and effort on that because I don't want people to feel like I'm just, you know, using and abusing their town. I want to make it feel lived in, and I'm also really interested in setting and the wonderful thing about this character, who is really kind of rootless, is that I can really set a book in the place that suits the story best. And in a way, the story that I'm telling comes out of the place that it's in. This book, Tear It Down, set in Memphis, would have been a different book if I'd set it in Austin or I'd set it in Atlanta.
Or Detroit.
So that's part of the fun, is sort of finding what that setting wants to tell me. So what's the story that's going to come out of that particular place?
Very cool. That's a great way to think about it.
It's a weird process. Writers are very strange people.
Well, that's all right. We still like having them into Lake Effect anyway. So, well, Nick Petrie, thanks so much. Best of luck on your tour, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Nick Petrie's latest novel, the fourth in his Peter Ash series, is called Tear It Down. He and Bonnie will reprise their conversation and talk about some other things probably too next Monday at Boswell Book Company.
We'll take one last break and then an international story that has played out within one family in Milwaukee. We'll learn about the documentary about a Northwest Milwaukee Chinese restaurant when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Yen Ching Restaurant on Good Hope Road in Milwaukee's Northwest Side has been serving Chinese-American dishes like chow mein and mushu beef for decades.
A few years ago, local film student and Chinese national himself, Enon Wong, worked as a driver for the family-run restaurant. He became interested in the family story, specifically its generational dynamics.
Wong directed and edited a documentary of the same name, which showed at the Milwaukee Film Festival. Yujin Wong is producer of Yen Ching and Enon's wife. She explains to Lake Effect's Mayan Silver what initially attracted them to the story.
Because the Chen, the owner, the Mr. Chen, he wanted his younger son to come back to his family to help the family business. But his younger son doesn't want to do this. They are so different. So maybe the contradictions between the father generation and the son generation is a really interesting thing. And also Chinese culture behind this is really interesting because the father, Mr. Chen, he wanted to have his family reunion or being together forever. But his son, he want to go away. So this contradiction is really interesting.
So he worked at this Yenshin restaurant. He knew about the family dynamics. How did it come about that he decided to make a movie about it?
Oh, yeah. Actually, at the very beginning, this was his project from class. So the class required them to have a small storytelling in the form of movie or in the form of the film. So he started working on his project, and at the very beginning, the documentary was only 20 minutes. So after the 20 minutes, he talked to his professor, Dick Blau, and the professor was suggest him to make a longer one because the culture behind this is so interesting. So they decided to expand the 20-minute story to a bigger one, to a larger one.
So you mentioned that the film goes into generational differences.
Mm-hmm.
What is the aspect of the story that makes it particularly Chinese?
Well, maybe Chinese food. Yeah, that's part of it. And, in Chinese culture, the family should be together. But in the United States, it's different. Everybody is they have their own freedom to go wherever they want. So I think maybe this is kind of the difference from our perspective.
Do you feel like Mr. Chen's son, the younger son who was going to college, do you think he was buying more into the Western culture rather than the Chinese culture?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think he has more sense about the Western culture, want to be away from the family, want to start his own business and doesn't want to inherit anything from the family.
So there's a scene in the film where the father admits that he would be okay with his son going, mm-hmm. striking out on his own in a different business, mm-hmm, or whatever, yeah. if he was able to financially make it.
Yeah.
Do you think that level of pressure was difficult for the younger son?
I don't think so. I think the younger son, he is very ambitious and he believes he is able to run a business or be success. So I don't think this can be a pressure for him. It's just he doesn't want to stay with his father. I think the biggest pressure is the pressure from working with his father or working with his family. Yeah.
You mentioned that the food is particularly Chinese about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything about the story that was particularly Chinese?
I think it's the spirit of his father. So in the movie, if you can see that, in the movie, the father, Mr. Chen, mentioned one very important concept in Chinese culture, which is a family should be together. So I think this is like the most important thing in the Chinese culture. Family should be together.
And was that something surprising when you came to the United States and that was not necessarily the way that all American families run their lives?
Well, yes and no. Yes, it's because, you guys are just like being away from home and do whatever, go wherever you guys want. No, it's because actually in China, a lot of younger generations or the younger families, they are accepting this kind of concept that a family doesn't have to be together forever. So it's more like half-half.
The tide is shifting in China, you would say?
Yeah.
And what was it like coming from China to Milwaukee in particular when you got here?
People are so into cheese.
That's right.
And a beer.
Cheese is not as big in Chinese cuisine at all, right?
Not at all. It's so different.
and was there anything culturally interesting? Because, you know, Yancheng is, I mean, there are some Chinese restaurants in Milwaukee, but not as, there's not a Chinatown, there's not a particular neighborhood where there's a big Chinese population. Mm-hmm. Did that surprise you? Like, how did that, what was that like dealing with that? Coming from China and then maybe having not such a strong Chinese presence in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I think when I moved to Milwaukee, I really didn't feel like a lot of Chinese people or Asian people here, but with like a couple of years living here, I figured out it's not that small community. So the Chinese community or the Asian community is just not that small. So I think it's growing or it's improving.
What was it like filming this film in terms of, you know, going to Yancheng and setting up filming and that type of thing? How did customers react to it?
Right. So it's kind of the trust building thing because it's, you know, the story is very private and it's a story about Chinese restaurants. So you have to like build the trust with the owner or with the character in the movie, in the film. Because my husband, we didn't have any fundings or any sponsors or anything. So everything he did or we did is just by ourselves. So including the editing, shooting or whatever. And it's really difficult. Yeah.
How did the Chens react to the movie when it was done?
At the very beginning, he was very like sensitive about it. He didn't like people shooting him in the movie, but with like building the trust with each other, he and his wife thought this may be a good opportunity for the public to know how their life is, and let the outside world listen to the Chinese community's voice and show them like what the life is behind their Chinese restaurant, because there are so many Chinese restaurants in the States, but you guys didn't know, like you guys don't know the stories or the culture behind it. So maybe it's a good opportunity to show them.
The Chens are immigrants to the United States,
yep.
But yet it didn't seem like the film totally centered around the immigrant experience. It was mostly, it seemed like it was a more universal message about being working people and, like you said, keeping a family together. But there was one scene, and the movie opened up with a scene of the older son trying to change the menu of the restaurant.
Yep.
And he was having a hard time spelling menu and explaining it to the person who was on the phone. Mm-hmm. What did the role of being an immigrant play in the film?
Because they story want to focus more on Chen and his restaurant and the story of the family. So I think the immigrant's role in this film is like a contradiction, especially for the different generations contradiction. And as you can see, Chen's wife, she also doesn't speak English, right? She was like trying to learn ABCD. And his older son doesn't know how to spell the menu. So it's kind of hard for them to live in the States. However, they're still chasing their American dreams. So that's a funny part. That's an interesting part. Yeah.
Was there anything that surprised you about when you learned more about the story?
Well, when people are, the first thing is Chinese food is kind of different from Chinese American food. So that is one thing. But the second is when we are seeing someone like Mr. Chen and his family are running a business, we thought maybe they are rich or maybe they're just like living a really, really good life. However, the reality is so different. They have to work very, very hard to keep their life. So this is something that surprised me. Yeah. From the surface, it's something. But under the surface, it's a totally different thing. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming and speaking about the film.
Sure. Thank you.
Yujin Wong produced the documentary Yen Qing that showed at the Milwaukee Film Festival. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mayan Silver, and our interview first aired in November.
And that's Friday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski and assistant producer Maddie Andre, along with the support of digital producer Lauren Sigfusson.
We get additional reporting from the WUWM news team, including Angelina Mosher-Salazar, Taryn Powell, Mayan Silver, and LaToya Dennis this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.